Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks very much for joining us today. I just had the great pleasure of talking with Sienna Craig about her new book, Healing Elements, Efficacy and the Social Ecologies of Tibetan Medicine. This was published with the University of California Press in 2012. This is a book that's not just a really brilliant exploration of the practices of Tibetan medicines in the 21st century in a range of different ethnographic contexts. It's also a huge pleasure to read. It's written in a kind of very affecting writerly style that makes it fun, it makes it transporting, and it makes it very transformative as a narrative, regardless of what field or expertise you're coming to the book with or without. The interview is quite extensive, so I'm going to keep my introductory comments short, but I'll just say that the book really takes on the idea of a traditional medicine as part of a dichotomy with what we might think of as modernity. It humanizes the practices of Tibetan medicines by bringing us into the experiences of many different kinds of individuals that are experiencing, producing, and practicing Tibetan medicines in lots of different kinds of related but distinct contexts. And it's also a really, really good story. It's also kind of a model of what can happen when you work on material that you care deeply about. And that care is on every single page of this book. So this is a book that's going to be really required reading for anybody who works in the academic or practical fields of traditional medicine, certainly Tibetan medicine, but also with related and allied fields that have to do with what's typically called complementary or alternative medicine or the study of traditional medicines. But it's also a really wonderful addition to the literature of modern Tibet, to the literature of modern China, and also to the history of science and medicine more broadly. So I really, as I've mentioned already, really, really enjoyed this book. I got a lot out of it. I hope you enjoy the book, and I hope you also enjoy the conversation. We're here today to talk with Sienna Craig about her new book, Healing Elements, Efficacy and the Social Ecologies of Tibetan Medicine. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Sienna, and thanks very much for making time in the middle of the teaching semester to talk with me today about your fabulous, fabulous new book.
Thank you so much, Carla. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
So could you start us off, as is traditional for the channel, by saying a little bit about yourself and your background, and specifically, how did you come to the study of Tibet?
Sure. So the story of how I came to study Tibet and culturally Tibetan communities in the Nepal Himalaya begins almost exactly 20 years ago. I was an undergraduate study abroad student in Nepal and went to Nepal at that time as a religion major, comparative religion major, thinking that I would go and do some work on women's religious experience in Tibetan monastic communities, but soon got pulled into a place that that led me down the track, if you will, of Tibetan medicine, but actually first by being pulled into the world of veterinary medicine and how people take care of animals in the Tibetan cultural world. So that's where it began.
Wow. And you talk a little bit about this as well at the beginning of your book. So it's a really fascinating story, and I urge all listeners to go and take a look, because it's also kind of, for me at least, reading this really a model of the kind of work that can come out of following your interests and your passions and the road that leads you to your academic subject. So it's a really, I think, inspiring story as well.
Thank you.
So the current book that we're talking about today explores, among many other things, and we'll get to many aspects of this, I imagine, in the course of our conversation, the practices and contexts of what you alternately call Tibetan medicines or Soa Rigpa in Nepal and China today. So how did you find yourself working on this particular topic? Can you situate this specific study within the larger trajectory of your research?
Sure. The study of Tibetan medicine or Tibetan medicines, Soa Rigpa, which means the science of healing, roughly in Tibetan, began really by working with lineage-based practitioners in northern Nepal who I met, again, 20 years ago in great part because they knew something about horses as well as taking care of humans. And in the course of those relationships, I quickly realized, the profound sorts of change that this generation of practitioners were navigating from a shift between institutional or rather lineage-based practice to institutions and the creation of those institutions, to questions about the future of knowledge transmission and even the future of medicinal plants in some of these parts of the High Himalaya. The Tibet part came basically through a combination of synergies national misfortunes, which led to interesting opportunities for me. I had planned to do all of my PhD research in Nepal and in different parts of highland Nepal than places I had spent time before. But I was setting out to do field work in 2002, at a time when the Nepali government was in a state of emergency and very unstable, and at the same time got an opportunity through one of my advisors colleague, Vincent Adams, to come work on a project in Lhasa. And it was, as I set out, unclear exactly to me how I was going to make a dissertation out of all of this and where and how Tibetan medicine would continue to fit into that, how I would square the experiences of folks from highland Nepal with people working in large state institutions of Tibetan medicine in a place like Lhasa. But it did come together in the end.
Now, we've talked a little bit about this before we started the interview, but this study had its roots in your dissertation research, but doesn't exactly recapitulate what's in the dissertation. There were some transformations along the way. So would you talk a little bit about those transformations? Were there any major changes that mark the process for you? Were there any major transformations in the way you were thinking about the project that shaped the way you wrote the book and that importantly differed from how you approached the dissertation?
Absolutely. My dissertation ended up being a much more focused study on the emergence of a pharmaceutical industry, really, around Tibetan medicine. And it came out of being based in Lhasa for those 2 years, while I was also working on a project that was synergistic with my PhD research and emerged in a sense through one chapter of both my PhD and what became this book around women's and children's health, or maternal health in particular. But my PhD advisor was always warning against biting off too large a project, really, for the dissertation itself. And after 2 years of living and working in Lhasa, although I had been working with practitioners in Nepal in some cases since the early 90s, in other cases since the late 90s, trying to fit Nepal into my PhD felt like an impossible task, and it felt better to keep things just focused on what I had gathered in these 2 years in Lhasa, Tibet. So that's how the decision to focus my PhD in the way that I did emerged. But in sitting down to think about how to write a book and how to transform my PhD into, at least in part, a very different book, I really felt like there was no way I couldn't include Nepal, because the story of the book and the story I really felt I needed to tell was a comparative one, was a story about how, on the surface, very different groups of practitioners connect with each other, how they how their struggles inform each other, how their practice merges and diverges at different points. So I had to back up a little bit in order to see the broader picture, and that's also not necessarily an easy thing to do for a PhD because it's so much about diving in.
Right. Now, one of the really wonderful things about the book, as we have it, and as I've already mentioned, it's a great book. And one of the great things about it is how readable it is. It's really a pleasure to read. And that's really something that we don't often find in an academic book. It's certainly not an academic book that treats in such a sophisticated way this whole suite of issues surrounding medicine and health and efficacy and evidence and many, many other of the topics we're going to talk about. Can you talk a little bit about your decision to write the book the way you did? How did you approach the kind of narrative arc that you set up in the book and the kind of writing style that you brought to bear in the chapters, which ranges from dialogue to a very personal feeling way of describing and narrating the events here?
Well, I think fundamentally, I have always felt like I was too invested in the people in this book and the moments of both personal and professional intensity and transformation to not write the book in a sense in this way. I love to write. It's a craft and a discipline that means a lot to me. This is not the first time in a sense that I tried to integrate different narrative styles or the tools of creative nonfiction into ethnography. And there are many people that do it better than me and many people that I've learned from. The person that's coming to mind right now is Kieran Narayan. And so reading works by people whose voices I think come through clearly in their text, but whose ethnographies also do or can read like stories was something I went to a lot while thinking about the structure. The structure itself changed over time. Initially, I had an idea of actually constructing the book around specifically the five elements that are important in Tibetan medical theory, and I wrote sort of short like prose poems that framed each of these chapters, and you know that was fun, and it helped me get into the writing, but in the end they didn't belong in the book. So, you know, there are a lot of things like that didn't end up in the book, but that helped me find the particular voice I think I needed to write this story. And by story, I don't mean that it's not true or it's not based in real ethnography, but I do see it very much as something that has an arc to it and a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Now, two central questions frame the book, and you set these out at the beginning. How is efficacy determined? And what is at stake in those determinations? And the chapters are going to sequentially introduce several practitioners, patients, individuals, contexts, and different kinds of landscapes and topographies through which we're going to see the emergence and construction and destruction of different ways of thinking about and making efficacy in the context you're looking at. One of the things that comes up again right at the beginning of the book, but that resurfaces periodically, and so it emerged to me as being something that was that seemed at least very important from the perspective of one reader to how you were thinking about and framing the topics, was this idea of social ecologies. So you describe the book as a study of the various social ecologies in which, and this is a quote, therapies are made and evaluated, practitioners are trained, and patients are treated. And you evoke various concepts used by some other authors, ethnographers, that help us think through what this might mean as a social ecology: the mindful body, the body ecologic, the body-mind-world dynamic. So I wonder if you could get us started in this exploration of the landscape of the book by talking a little bit about this idea of social ecologies and its centrality or not to the way you're thinking about and structuring the narrative.
Sure. I think you did a very thoughtful job of framing that. I think that I landed on the idea of social ecologies for a number of different key reasons. On the one hand, place is really important in this book, and trying to think not about place not just as the physical space of a factory or the shrine room in a village doctor's house, but rather the ways that ecologies in the broadest sense of the term and the places in which particular plants grow or particular kinds of knowledge is transmitted makes a difference in how medicine is effective or why it isn't effective at a certain moment or to a certain person. And I've also been influenced over, I would say, the years of becoming an ethnographer and an anthropologist by works by people like Gregory Bateson. And I was very much, I returned to and very was very much influenced by his concepts of ecology of mind as I was thinking about this book. So ecologies are not only places in the world that are populated by people and other beings, such as to be social spaces or social environments, but also an ecology of mind was a way to think about the different and the shared ecologies of mind was also another way to think about social ecologies of practitioners and what they know and how they know it and how they challenge each other, the dynamics within a family that would help them or hinder them sometimes in figuring out how to navigate the different healthscapes that were available to them. So the idea of social ecologies kind of works on those two levels. And then finally, it just seemed like a concept, a theoretical concept that fit Tibetan social realities pretty well or ethnographic realities pretty well because of the ways that in Tibetan vernacular people talk about and words evoke this connection between ecological and social worlds and even moral concepts of those worlds.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, as we get into the body chapters of the book, the first two chapters each chronicle one day spent in one of the main ethnographic sites featured in the book. The first chapter chronicles one day in 2008 in the life of Amchi from rural Nepal in Mustang. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, actually, it's Mustang.
Mustang. Mustang.
Yep.
I'm thinking, you know, Mustang it, Sally.
Yep,
I always
yep.
go to Sally. So yep. Mustang. Okay.
Well, and that was one of the reasons this is where I first went when I was interested in horses and everybody thought, oh, of course, you know, it's where the Mustangs are, but it's actually, it's something different.
Okay. So we're in 2008, we're in one day in the life of two brothers who are both practitioners in Mustang, Nepal. You take us into the I pronounce everything wrong, so I should tell you that I pronounce
English
wrong.
You're doing great.
So listeners know this, but you should also know this. The Lo Kun Fun Traditional Herbal Medicine Clinic and School, and these two brothers who run it. So that this chapter emphasizes through this day in the life, the many different responsibilities, the different kinds of responsibilities that are taken on by a rural Amchi, okay, in a national context in which Tibetan medicine is not recognized by the government. So could you talk a little bit about, could you introduce these brothers for us and talk a little bit about this issue of the different kinds of responsibilities emerging in this context for both of them and what that does to help us understand the larger points that you're making in the chapter?
Sure. The brothers are folks that I have known since 1995. One is a householder, a tantric householder priest. The other is a celibate monastic, a monk. And they have been good friends and interlocutors for many, many years. Part of what inspired me to write these first two chapters in this way, but really the inspiration for that form came from thinking about the life that these two people lead and literally going through this day and then reflecting on it in my field notes later on. And then turning that eventually into this chapter. The main points that I wanted to make with this are one, that we tend to think about doctors or practitioners of medicine as just doing that, just being focused on the practice of medicine. But for so many people in so much of the world who practice different forms of healing, that's not the case at all. And I thought that the dynamic between these two brothers as they navigate between their responsibilities as ritual practitioners to the local king of this region, or two individuals trying to navigate across languages and continents, the running of a local NGO and negotiations with donors, to being part of an extended family, and to being responsible for a whole host of young students for whom they are not just teachers, but also in loco parentis figures, and navigating through all of these different worlds at once. At the same time, I wanted to give a vision of what it means to actually be the kind of practitioner who still not only is transmitting knowledge to a younger generation and practicing, but also who is still making, they still make their own medicines, and they're concerned about the future of medicinal plants. And part of the chapter is about the cultivation fields that they are attempting to manage in fields outside of the village where they live. So I also wanted to get across very quickly in the book, or get through rather, to cut through the idea that somehow being a traditional doctor means that you're not modern, or means that you're not somehow connected to global networks. And hopefully the chapter also does that.
Absolutely. And one of the, a couple of this really striking ways, at least for me, that the chapter does that are bringing us into the process by which you're not just observing, you know, what we might think of as sort of a stereotypical traditional medical doctors. You're also working on grant proposals with them. And that process of being actively involved in not just going to the cultivation grounds for medicinal plants, but also working through the nitty-gritty of putting together a grant proposal was actually really interesting and important, I think, to have right at the beginning of the book. Another thing that was really striking, and this is going to be interesting to any readers who come to this with a deep concern with the history of science or the history of STS, was this phenomenon whereby you describe translating the kinds of records that are being kept in the logbooks into statistics. What happens
yes.
when you're, you know, which is a huge transformation. That's really, really fascinating here. So I'll just signal that for listeners. There's a lot in here that really speaks to not just East Asian history, but also really important transformations within the history of STS and the history of the sciences that I think are really important.
And actually, just to add one thing there, that is something that I am still exploring to this day. In fact, I just met with Tenzin, one of the doctors in this chapter, last month at a conference in Korea. And part of what we were discussing was precisely this ongoing history of these records and what they mean, what they hinder, what they allow for him. And it's very clear still that even though this is now 4 or 5 years since the material at the core of this chapter, that the numbers are not all at all about the practice of medicine to him, or very in a very tangential way, but they are absolutely essential to how he envisions the possible futures for this practice for people who are younger than he is, especially in connection to government recognition and the issues around legibility, you know, sort of making visible the work of healing that they do.
And this integration of computer technology and of sort of data, or the transformation of knowledge into the terminology and form of data, also comes up, albeit in a very different context, in the next chapter. So chapter two also chronicles one day spent in one of the main ethnographic sites of the book, but here it's a day in 2010, and it's spent at Arura Tibetan Medical Group, which is a major Tibetan medical institution in urban China in Qinghai province. And so it's a very different setting. You note in this part of the book that among the many differences between these two settings, there's not only here a more developed governmental structure behind the practice, but also that there are more daily transactions and translations. And by the end of our conversation, as by the end of the book, we'll get to translation explicitly if we don't before then. Translations across medical systems here than there were in the context in Nepal in the previous chapter. And these systems include biomedicine, Tibetan medicine, Chinese medicine, etc. These are just a few of the many systems across which translation's happening. Now, this chapter emphasizes the engagement between Soa Rikpa, the biomedical sciences, and commercial pharmaceutical production. And a lot of the story happens in the course of your observing doctors, watching doctors prescribe medicines, watching doctors in action in their practice in this hospital. So just as you did in the first chapter, could you talk about that process? What was perhaps the most striking experience for you in the course of this day watching medicinal practices, and how does that help us understand similarly the larger kind of work that's happening in this chapter?
Well, I think one of the key moments for me in that day, and therefore also in this chapter, were both the first doctor I observed in the morning. His name is Namla Kerr, and he's in the GI and internal medicine unit. And then later on in the day, watching one of the most, and in fact, now he's the most senior practitioner in this institution, navigate with patients. And part of what sticks with me is the ways that in both cases, the practitioner moved between oral and written modes of communicating, not only with patients, but with the students that were around them and in the room, and how in those transitions between local dialects of Tibetan and in certain cases also Chinese, and then what got put in the computer or written on a prescription form, the two different worlds that those ways of communicating came to not just represent, but came to be. And I think the other thing that remains striking to me in this chapter in a different way than the first one is actually the agency, if you will, of patients and the ways that patients would negotiate and navigate and push and question even these very senior doctors, not in a disrespectful way at all, but in a way that showed their own struggles to integrate or to, you know, translate or wrap their heads around the different possibilities for diagnosis and for treatment that they knew by previous experience or by other families' experience could be available to them. And this includes a navigation around what that is not at all unique to aspects of biomedical practice today. What tests are needed, and why do you need certain kinds of reassurances that come from a machine, or why do you want them versus the kinds of reassurances that come from having a senior practitioner take your pulse?
Great. So among the many other really notable moments in this chapter, and there's a really wonderful account of your teaching an English class and discussing the social, the personal, the medical, the material ramifications of a recent earthquake, as that comes up in the context of language learning, which is itself a really interesting metaphor and example of the kinds of translations on many levels that are happening in the book. But in addition to that, one of the really interesting moments here is an example of something that comes up also later on in the book. And this is a moment where you talk about a prevailing concern with climate change in a way that for me was really interesting and really surprising in a way, because it's not the kind of question that I thought to bring to the book, right? So it was really pleasantly surprising and actually made me think about the history of Materia Medica in a completely different way. And I'm really grateful for that. So for listeners who also may not immediately bring to or think to bring to the study of medicine and the history of medicine, the ethnography of medicine, a concern with global warming. Can you talk a little bit about that issue as it emerges for the people that you're working with and as it comes up as a prevailing concern in the book?
Absolutely. It is a, if not counterintuitive, not a necessarily intuitive piece, but it's absolutely essential for everybody in this book, be they the small-scale producer who still goes out and harvests his own plants or animal or mineral products, to these larger-scale institutions. When you have a medical system that is premised, at least in part, on the use of wildcrafted ingredients that part of their potency, part of their capacity to produce efficacy comes from the particular environments in which they're grown, and you have those environments being pretty radically transformed by climate change and also by patterns of harvesting or over-harvesting, you realize just how essential the link is between climate health or ecological health and the health of human beings. And so in different parts of the book, really, this issue comes up, be it folks talking about how a place where they particularly where they used to go to gather a particularly important ingredient, they no longer can find, to questions about other forms of environmental pollution that are potentially impacting ingredients that may look okay, but for whom you have to ask other kinds of questions about quality by virtue of the ways that the environment around those ingredients are changing. And there are a number of other examples of that, not just in this second chapter, but throughout.
Great. Thank you so much, Sienna. Now, as we move to chapter three looks at the ideas of lineage and legitimacy, and it uses these ideas to explore how learning Tibetan medicine, how state support and recognition of this practice produce forms of cultural and economic capital. Now, the chapter is going to go on to argue that standardized regulations of all kinds, including moral precepts about the behavior of healers, including state-approved curricula, including medical licensing, all these regulations are rooted in very particular histories and particular environments. Now, you look at various contexts in this chapter, and we could honestly spend the entire rest of the time just talking about this chapter. It's so rich, and there's so much going on here. What I want to do is just drop a few crumbs here for listeners so that they're aware of what's going on, and then ask you about something that actually comes up toward the end.
So, sure.
In many different ways, you're looking at turning around and exploring the question, what makes an Amchi a legitimate healer in the context of a village or within a government-supported institution of Tibetan medicine? And you look at the ways that sources of legitimacy are or are not the same, and how important lineage is to garnering legitimacy in these various different contexts. You explore, among various other phenomena here, situations in Nepal in which Tibetanness is actually associated with cultural backwardness. You look at the politically sensitive issues here. You look at the relationships between Tibetan medicines, traditional medicines, and NGOs. But toward the end of the chapter, one of the things that you do here is really, really quite striking. And this is bringing us into the dissertation of basically the equivalent of a dissertation defense or a PhD defense at a Tibetan medical college in Lhasa. This is a really striking moment because, among other things, it encapsulates not just these issues of legitimacy and lineage, but also issues of gender dynamics, this is a really important theme throughout the book. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this moment and what elements of this speak to larger issues at stake in this part of the book.
Sure. Well, I think you've hit on immediately on the reason why I chose to include this. Much of this chapter focuses on, in some ways, the tensions between internal and internalized understandings of legitimacy and more externalized or state-mandated frames for evaluative frames. But in the part of this chapter that is about my friend and colleague Mingyi during her defense, it was really a combination of both of those things. She, and in the context of highly gendered dynamics, I think the challenge in sitting in that room watching her go through the defense was in part the and it showed on her face at the time, but the constraints that she felt she was under in order to try to get everything she had to say about this topic that was still very much filled with questions for her, distilled in a way that would be equivalent to a passing set of marks from her senior male colleagues or teachers, and to at the same time basically show that that there are deep internal debates around what should count as legitimate knowledge within an inner circle of elite practitioners. And that's a kind of dynamic that that is rarely shown to people outside of Tibetan medicine, but that was so central to Mingyi's experience and trying to raise, in a sense, taboo questions about knowledge transmission or about how we know what we know about key parts of Tibetan medical theory, and to have people listen or dismiss her was a very high stakes moment.
Thank you. Now, as we move to the next part of the book, we move to a chapter, or the next chapters of the book, rather. We move to a chapter that draws on fieldwork from Kathmandu, Mustang, and Chai Province, and focuses on what happens in small private clinics and on how individuals narrate their own experiences of illness. So you draw out a theme here of mapping illness, which speaks to what you refer to here to in terms of what Susan Sontag calls the kingdom of the sick. So I'll just mention some of these questions that you're looking at here, and this is taken from the book itself. So the chapter is looking at how social ecologies are maintained and transformed through migration and the experience of modernity, how medicines are circulated among people in Nepal, in China, in the US, and their families, and how specific diseases and patterns of illness are linked to material, to cosmological, and to place-based understandings of the causes of health problems, and causes in many different ways and in many different registers. Now, among the more really affecting and striking moments in this chapter are two vignettes in which you are introducing us to two different individuals who are narrating their own experiences of their illness and linking those up to some sort of larger structures of various sorts. One of the women that you narrate is a woman in Qinghai province that you describe from an encounter in July 2010, who describes her illness as being sent to her. I wonder, could you talk a little bit about this case and this woman? Because this really encapsulates a lot of the kinds of phenomena, for me at least, that are happening in this chapter in terms of her own description, how you identified her illness, how she is linking up regions that we might otherwise not associate with each other, science and religion, and all of that's happening really in this one vignette. And so could you introduce her for us and talk a little bit about her?
Sure. So the person in question was, at the time of the interview, 67 years old and was suffering from what sort of came to the surface as what biomedicine would call Parkinson's. But for her, there were that didn't mean anything either, obviously in English, but also in Chinese. And she talked about a whole range of different moments in her life that she correlated with this shaking, which was the primary symptom. But she talked about it first in terms of, you know, where she had to go to try and get treatment and how confusing and expensive that was, how she didn't know the name of what she was suffering from, but she pulled out her pills and we saw that it was, essentially dopamine, which again confirmed my sensibility that, oh yes, maybe this is Parkinson's, but then it sort of keeps distilling, and her voice cracks and she begins to cry, and we say, you know, should we stop the interview? And then she, you know, she goes on and talks about how this shaking is connected in her mind not just to a disorder of the bodily channels or tsa, which are often associated with neurological problems, but also with the possibility of illness or ill health being sent to her by and it was vague in the conversation, most likely a nefarious spirit, but also could be the negotiation between another person and said spirit. And this theme of sent illness is, you know, has a long history in medical anthropology. One of the main examples that come to mind is the discussion of HIV early on in Haiti through Paul Farmer's work as an illness that was sent by sorcery. And, you know, you could go back to Evans Pritchard and think about this. And, but what was interesting to me in this case was sort of how the material world, unraveled and went deeper into these deeper, more in some ways more substantial questions of causality, and yet equally important to her were the economics and the effective changes that this had on her life, or her ability to sleep or to not sleep, or her ability to pay for medications versus paying for her children's tuition for school and things like that. So, it just was a good example of showing how illness operates. It's at all of these different registers, really.
That's right. And I think the economics of the issue, this is something that recurs as a theme throughout the book as well. It's the importance of cost and of value and of money, frankly, in shaping what's happening in a lot of these cases in a way that's really, really, really striking. Now, this leads us to this next part of the book. And chapters 5 through 7 look specifically at the construction of different kinds of value when we're talking about materia medica in particular. Chapter 5 considers the implementation of what you call here, and what is called more generally, good manufacturing processes. And that's capital G, capital M, capital P for listeners who are unfamiliar with this concept, GMP we'll call it, and related practices, and sort of looks at the consequences of this rubric and the practices that go alongside it and with it on the production of Tibetan medicines. So because this is a really striking part of the book, I'm left with this image of this Irish venture capital guy, and we'll have that with me for a while. And I'll just tantalizingly leave that out there for listeners. You have to read the book so that you can also meet the Irish venture capital guy. But can you talk a little bit about this concept of GMP and how and why it's central to the kind of work that this chapter is doing within the larger context of the arguments of the book?
Sure. So GMP became for me especially during the 2 years of living in Lhasa for my PhD, it functioned in so many different ways, or it came to mean so many different things. On the one hand, it was this set of regulations that were, when you actually read them, it's not that they were innocuous, but they were relatively vague enough that that factories could potentially have sort of molded them into a set of operating procedures that were relatively finely tuned to the idiosyncrasies and the important elements of Tibetan medical production, but they came to operate as ideology, and that's part of what I argue in this chapter, that they and as a boogeyman of sorts for Tibetans who were trying to navigate the scaling up of materia medica and medicinal production for commercial purposes. They became a proxy for all that was wrong with standardization. They became a metaphor for a kind of internal colonization of Tibetan medicine by not only Chinese-style biomedicine, but also to a certain extent by state-sanctioned TCM, and in a way that often mirrored ethnic and nationalist arguments about the place of Tibetans in Tibet or Tibetans in China. But these practices evoked really huge questions around how you know that what you produce is of quality and will have the efficacious or the beneficial effects that one hopes when one produces a medicine. And it's also a space that connects Tibetan medicine to much larger histories of standardization and regulation of medical production generally. I mean, going back to things like the creation of the Safe Food and Drug Act in the U.S. in the early 20th century, and to all of the good intentions behind trying to control for things, to control for quality, and yet what can go so terribly wrong when the control apparatuses themselves become the stamp of quality, but the thing itself becomes, if not empty, then not necessarily good enough, and becomes more a fetishized commodity than something that has therapeutic value. And it's not to say that that is what is always or only happening with Tibetan, commercially produced Tibetan formulas today, but that's the dynamic and the set of fears that punctuated this moment in the GMP production in Tibet. And the other thing here is that when I was living in Lhasa in 2003-2004, there was a state mandated deadline that factories had to conform to these new regulations or be closed. And so that's sort of where the boogeyman element came into this, or the need to fabricate the look of what GMP was supposed to be about, and yet still be asking all of these internal questions about whether or not this was making their medicines better or worse.
Great. Thank you very much. And I'll just mention for listeners who may not yet have had a chance to read the book also, a couple of other things that come out of this chapter that may not be obvious to somebody who's looking at the title or a brief description of a book on Tibetan medicine. And that is, you use this issue of the GMP to open out into larger discussions in this chapter too of governmentality and of capitalism with Chinese characteristics. And so there are larger implications for how we understand the social, economic, cultural, political, and conceptual frames within which this is happening. That's really, really interesting, whether or not a reader is inherently interested in medicine and medical practice. This is about much more than medicine on some level.
It becomes something that's also about consumptive desires and the place of Buddhism or Tibet in people's imagined landscapes of what or who those things are.
Mm-hmm. It's really fascinating, and it's one of the many reasons that I think this book is going to be not just great to read, but also really interesting and important to assign in the context of seminars and the context of discussion groups. So, well done. Really great part of the
chapter.
Thanks. So as we move to the next chapter, chapter 6 looks at how Amchi interact with conservation and development practitioners, policies, and projects, specifically in a region of Yunnan province called Shangri-La. And there's also ethnographic work here that comes from experiences in Nepal and in Bhutan as well. So the chapter, among the many things that it does, you take us into a conference in Han, you take us into a meeting in Nepal between WWF, not World Wrestling Federation, World Wildlife Federation officers who are trying to initiate and help guide you and others through a grant proposal which involves redefining or packaging the kind of rhetoric of and the definition of Tibetan medicine in really interesting ways. There's a lot going on here. One of the things, though, that's going on here that I want to ask you about, because this is two things, actually, because these are conceptually, I think, this is another example of the ways that these chapters really speak to not just what's happening conceptually in terms of Tibetan medicines and healing practices, but also phenomena in which they're embedded that have that are potentially really, really interesting also to people who don't necessarily think of themselves as working on or reading about medicine regularly. So I'll get to what those are. The chapter links medical anthropology and political ecology by looking at how the role of these healthcare providers and transmitters of Tibetan medicines, how their knowledge intersects with involvement, as I said, in conservation or development. So there's a term here that's really interesting that you take on and explore that I wonder if you could speak a little bit about, and that's the idea of conservation. How does conservation function in this chapter? How is it understood by the actors that you're talking about, and in what way is that important, or like I said, or not? Perhaps this is just an idiosyncrasy of my own reading, but is that important to what's going on here?
Well, it's a really good question. I think part of the issue, and in a way this speaks to themes of translation as well, but part of why the doctors that I work with in these different contexts get pulled into conservation discourse or into actual ICDPs or integrated conservation and development projects or programs is that they have knowledge that not only of plants, but of also landscapes, landscapes of disease, as well as landscapes of materia medica. But I think that conservation in and of itself is for them and for me a tricky term, because on the one hand, I would say that some of the doctors that I work with try to latch on to the idea of conservation or even preservation of plants and also of their own practice because of the different kinds of political, social, economic threats that they are under or the kinds of ecological threats that materia medica are under. But the challenge, of course, in the term conservation or in the ways that it gets used is that, again, it can be like GMP or like a standard curriculum, it can too quickly or too much in a totalizing way box people's practice in. And this comes out as I'm talking to one of my doctor friends about the use of musk, which is a rare and in some cases endangered ingredient that should be used in a number of Tibetan formula. And we have this really interesting back and forth about, even though he's been involved for many years in conservation projects, how he would still make the choice, if he had to make the choice, of getting even a small amount of real musk to put into a formula he was creating, as opposed to a substitute, either a plant substitute or even musk that was coming from deer that were being raised more in captivity. Because that's what is going in his mind to make the best, most potent medicines to have the best possible effect on his patients. And for him, the moral buck stopped there. And and then at the same time, I think people in this chapter and in other interactions I've had are very conscious of the potential for lack of a better term, hypocrisy in ideas of conservation, that somehow, you know, you conserve or preserve or put into a box people who have less power or places that are more marginal, and that doesn't require people who are overusing resources to change their behavior or how they use things. And this comes up in a set of dynamics around Coca-Cola in this chapter, and also the kind of commodity fetishism stuff in the previous chapter with boutique Tibetan formulas that are being sold on the Chinese market.
Great. Thank you so much. And I'll just kind of highlight something that you've said as part of your discussion, which is this phrase substitution, or this word substitution. Another really interesting thing that's happening in this chapter is a really thoughtful interrogation of the idea of and the epistemology of substitution. Sort of, what does it mean to even claim that something is a substitute for something else, and the different kinds of frames that that's embedded within. I also really thought that was a really wonderful aspect of what's going on here. Right. So as we come to the last body chapter before the conclusion, we come to a super, super fascinating part of this story. This is the chapter that follows the social life or the biography of a Tibetan formula, which is an 11-ingredient compound used during childbirth. This is super, super fascinating. So I'm going to definitely ask you a little bit about this. This formula became one of two drugs examined in the first hospital-based randomized clinical trial in Tibet in this hospital that you worked in. So could you, I'm just going to put this out here and ask you in as broad as terms as possible, can you talk a little bit about what's going on in this case and the aspects of what's going on here in this chapter with this trial that you feel are most illustrative of the larger arguments that you're trying to make in this chapter?
Sure. Well, I think in a way this was the logical last full chapter of the book, because it brings, in a sense, every single other piece that came before it together through the story of this one medicine. And what I mean by that is that in the story of how this one formula is historically positioned, is actually produced, how people think about it, how people use it, we see issues around patient experience, around modes of legitimacy, you know, where and how is it legitimate to use this medicine, but also what kinds of practitioners can make it or should make it and can prescribe it. It gets at issues related to stuff in the previous chapter about the ingredients themselves, where they're sourced, how that is changing, and to the core issues in the GMP chapter about how do you produce a formula that can be comparable or be thought of as a potential comparison with a, you know, a biomedical chemical compound, which is in many ways the epitome of a standardized formulation. And how do you do all of this in a context in which there isn't a precedent for this kind of clinical research, and where research itself and the ethics of research and the question of what research is for is also very, there are a lot of competing or counter, you know, point counterpoint kind of narratives going through this about what is good clinical practice or good or ethical practice. And so and what kinds of then real world implications do these kinds of forays into high science for a quote unquote traditional medicine mean? What do they do to its value? What do they do to the ways that, that these formulas then get positioned vis-a-vis biomedical institutions or other biomedicines? And so, basically the story goes through, you know, the discovery, if you will, of this one particular medication and how it comes to be thought of as an equivalent or as a possible comparison to a biomedical drug called misoprostol. The really uncanny connections or parallels between Shishe Chukchik, which is the Tibetan drug, and misoprostol, both are help the uterus to contract. Both can be used for their abortifacient qualities, in other words, to help induce early term abortion. So there's an interesting morality set of questions there. And then also, though, this question of what does it mean to make a one-to-one comparison, to say, okay, this medicine is equivalent to this other one, and to look at all the different ways that the Tibetan doctors were basically telling us they're not. And we can set up a trial in the best possible way to capture their samenesses and to see how they do in relation to each other, but that it is a certain kind of violence, not to use too strong a word, but to see one single medicine in isolation, or even beyond that, to see one ingredient as the active ingredient, as we like to do in aspects of biochemistry or biomedicine. Rather, there are a continuum of things that create the capacity for a desired outcome or create efficacy. And then the other piece of this chapter is really about the kind of interpersonal relationships between the Tibetan practitioners on this project and the Western practitioners on this project, and how this all coalesces around the experiences of primarily rural, but also included in the end, urban Tibetan women who were giving birth, and the stakes involved there are high, in part because of the truths and the stories about life and death for Tibetan women and children in a kind of global public health sense. So it does all of those things, but I think my favorite part of this whole story was really the ways that my colleague Minky, who the readers met in an earlier chapter, does this incredible dance of pharmacology and history and translating science across culture when she figures out how to produce a version of this 11-ingredient formula for the specific purposes of this clinical trial. And that, I think, her brilliance in those moves really illustrate the flexibility that is inherent in Tibetan medical practice, but also the ways that standards of all sorts are applied all the time to what it means to make a good formula, even if those standards would be recognized as non-standardized by a biomedical viewpoint.
And a couple of other really, just to kind of mention for listeners, because this is a super, super rich chapter, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on. The chapter also brings out the ways that religion and science are implicated in Western medical practice by looking carefully at the phenomenon of the placebo and the role of the placebo here in this particular clinical trial itself. And also there's this wonderful depiction of having a certain subset of the drugs in the trial blessed.
Right.
What the implications of that are. Do you want to talk just very briefly about that part of it? Because it also seems to be a really crucial part of what's going on here, this question of what it is and what the implications are of blessing a subset of these pills.
Sure. Yeah, it was a fascinating moment where we had decided, we meaning myself and my Tibetan colleagues working on this project, had decided that it would be of benefit to have a mendrup or a medicine empowerment ritual for the special batches of this drug, Shishechukchik, that had been created based on Mingi's rewriting of the formula for this clinical trial. And so we figure out a way to bring in a high Tibetan Lama who does these kinds of ritual empowerments a lot to perform this. And this is something he's done also for other medicinal factories. And there's this just, it was really in some ways hilarious, but also very important exchange that goes on where, you know, the Rinpoche, the Lama is asking, why are you doing this and why are you only blessing this one medicine? And my colleague Minky talks about how she essentially answers by saying, well, Tibetan medicine is being known in the world in these new ways, and we now need to test it and show that it works according to these other standards. He says, but why are you only using one medicine? And she explains, you know, the kind of narrowing process of the RCT. And they go through this whole thing about the placebo and whether or not they should bless the placebo, which had also been created. And in the end, they decide to bless both this new drug and the placebo, in part because the whole idea of a placebo is kind of nonsensical. This idea that there's just a medicine to heal the mind, as the literal translation goes from the Tibetan. And yet at the same time to say that, well, any blessed substance is going to have beneficial qualities. So even if the women in this trial who get the placebo, in a sense, only get the placebo, at least we know that they're going to be getting something that's also got some ritual efficacy to it. So, okay, let's go ahead and let's bless them all. And And also just really reflective, interesting comments from the Lama, for instance, about, you know, how we're describing the placebo. And he says, according to the teachings of the medicine Buddha, every substance on earth has the potential to be medicine. He didn't say this, but they also have the potential to be poison, which is a theme that comes out in Chinese medicine too, I think. And he says, so if this no medicine medicine puts the patient's mind at ease, then how is it not medicine? And, you know, it's just sort of really unraveling the kinds of logical assumptions that go along with this conventional use of a placebo at this point in the practice of an RCT. And there's another funny, similar moment around the idea of randomization and blinding and the ways that these two are truly ritualized practices that we take to be the pinnacle of scientific practice, but that are also about a certain kind of clinical or scientific magic.
That's right. Thank you so much. And I just want to direct listeners to that chapter especially, but really to the whole book, because there's so much going on here that's really fascinating. So Sienna, I've taken up a lot of your time. I just have one final question before we move to our closing and my two final questions for you. And that's a question about the conclusion. And it's really just to talk a little bit about a central concept that you bring up in the conclusion as a way of drawing all this together. And that's a concept that I alluded to at the very beginning of our conversation and that now we're at the end, so that I'll ask you to talk a little bit about. And this is the concept of translational science. Can you say a little bit about that and how that encapsulates what you're doing here?
Sure. Well, I first encountered the term translational science when I first saw that, or translational medicine. I got really excited because I thought, yes, you know, exactly. And this was years ago. You know, this so captures the different kinds of challenges that I'm encountering ethnographically, or the ways that people I work with move across from theory to practice. And, you know, of course, as I learned more about the concept and learned in a sense about the narrowness or the specificity of that concept as it's often used, you know, from bench to bedside kind of thinking, I then began to sort of go back to it and say, well, what if we were to push this idea a little bit more and say, you know, translational science or translational medicine isn't just about moving something from a lab to the marketplace from the lab to the bedside, but rather that almost any kind of medical practice or healing practice is translational, and that part of what that translation is about are, you know, trying to get at what I say in the conclusion, the ethical ambiguities, the political risks, and the social and ecological impacts of defending and transforming any medical practice, but specifically here thinking about what it means to do that with a quote unquote traditional medicine. And so in some senses, the conclusion is that the entire book and this whole story is a chronicling of types of translational science. And that maybe if we, you know, keep thinking in that vein of the potentiality, yes, it's an ambiguous term, but there's a lot of potential in there for thinking then about new forms of interdisciplinary work, or even just being more conscious about the moments when those translations are occurring, and not necessarily assuming that one thing is equivalent to another thing, or to glossing over moments of translation, but instead to really embrace them and dive more deeply in.
Great. Well, Sienna, thank you so much. We've talked about a lot of the book, but of course, there's a lot about the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. Is there anything in particular that we didn't cover, but that you'd like to point out, and especially perhaps for listeners who haven't yet had an opportunity to read the book?
The only thing I think I would want to say at the end is something we haven't talked about at all, because it's not so much or directly about the content, but that is about who the book is dedicated to. In a preface, I talk about my friend and colleague Yeshe Lama, who Yeshe Chodron Lama, who I dedicate this book to, and she, along with some wonderful other people who were also mentors of mine, died in a quite tragic helicopter crash in Nepal in 2006. And Yeshe really embodied, I would say, so many of the best qualities of not only anthropology but also engaged practice in its fullest sense of the term. She navigated, and translation actually, she navigated between the worlds of being, you know, the daughter of an important Tibetan Lama who had fled into exile via Bhutan, and you know, navigating that space on the one hand, to being educated at Middlebury College here in Vermont, as well as at SOAS in London, and navigating between different ways of knowing the world, and working with practitioners of Tibetan medicine in a way that always felt not only respectful, but just so deeply engaged. So she was a friend, but she was also really an exemplar or a mentor, I would say, to me, as I dove into my own relationships with this complex terrain of Tibetan practice and the people whose in many different ways whose lives are formed or shaped by it and who depend on it.
Thank you so much. So now that the book is out, and congratulations on a fantastic book, what's next for you? Are there any projects that are currently inspiring you?
I'm working on a few different things right now. One of which is actually a study that takes me more into the realm, different realms of medical anthropology and science and technology studies, and less into Tibet. And that is working on an ethnographic study here at Dartmouth, at the medical school here, looking at the ways that medical students are enculturated and navigate through the process of becoming doctors at a moment. There have been other studies that have done that as well, but this is sort of looking at it at a moment when the curriculum of the medical school itself is undergoing radical reform, and the larger political economy in which doctors are being trained and going out to practice is also being pretty radically challenged and transformed, at least in this part of North America. And so I'm working on that, and also on projects that don't have Tibetan medicine at their core, but that still intersect with Tibetan medical practice in different ways, specifically around maternal and child health, issues about fertility and reproductive histories, reproductive loss as well. And that's coming out of a collaborative project that I've been working on with a biological anthropologist, Cynthia Bell, and a fellow cultural anthropologist and demographer, Jeff Childs.
Well, great. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to reading that work as well, and I'll look forward to talking with you about those books when they come out.
Great.
Thank you so much, Shannon. It's really been a pleasure, and congratulations again.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.